Chapter 8. They were peaceful and pleasant, those young and smoothly flowing days of ours. That is, that was the case as a rule, we being remote from the seat of war. But at intervals roving bands approached near enough for us to see the flush in the sky at night which marked where they were burning some farmstead or village, and we all knew, or at least felt, that some day they would come yet nearer, and we should have our turn. This dull dread lay upon our spirits like a physical weight. It was greatly augmented a couple of years after the Treaty of Troyes. It was truly a dismal year for France. One day we had been over to have one of our occasional pitched battles with those hated Burgundian boys of the village of Maxey, and had been whipped, and were arriving on our side of the river after dark, bruised and weary, when we heard the bell ringing the tocsin. We ran all the way, and when we got to the square we found it crowded with the excited villagers, and weirdly lighted by smoking and flaring torches. On the steps of the church stood a stranger, a Burgundian priest, who was telling the people new which made them weep, and rave, and rage, and curse, by turns. He said our old mad king was dead, and that now we and France, and the crown were the property of an English baby lying in his cradle in London. And he urged us to give that child our allegiance, and be its faithful servants and well-wishers. And said we should now have a strong and stable government at last, and that in a little time the English armies would start on their last march, and it would be a brief one, for all that it would need to do would be to conquer what odds and ends of our country yet remained under that rare and almost forgotten rag, the banner of France. The people stormed and raged at him, and you could see dozens of them stretch their fists above the sea of torch-lighted faces, and shake them at him, and it was all a wild picture, and stirring to look at, and the priest was a first-rate part of it too, for he stood there in the strong glare, and looked down on those angry people in the blandest and most indifferent way, so that while you wanted to burn him at the stake, you still admired the aggravating coolness of him. And his winding up was the coolest thing of all. For he told them how, at the funeral of our old king, the French king at arms, had broken his staff of office over the coffin of Harold VI, and his dynasty, at the same time saying, in a loud voice, "Good grant long life to Henry, King of France and England, our sovereign lord." And then he asked them to join him in a hearty amen to that. The people were white with wrath, and it tied their tongues for the moment, and they could not speak. But Joan was standing close by, and she looked up in his face, and said in her sober, earnest way, "I would I might see thy head struck from thy body." Then, after a pause, and crossing herself, "If it were the will of God." This is worth remembering, and I will tell you why. It is the only harsh speech Joan ever uttered in her life. When I shall have revealed to you the storms she went through, and the wrongs and persecutions, then you will see that it was wonderful that she said but one bitter thing while she lived. From the day that that dreary news came, we had one scare after another, the marauders coming almost to our doors every now and then, so that we lived in ever-increasing apprehension, and yet were somehow mercifully spared from actual attack. But at last our turn did really come. This was in the spring of 28. The Burgundians swarmed in with a great noise, in the middle of a dark night, and we had to jump up and fly for our lives. We took the road to Neufchâteau, and rushed along in the wildest disorder, everybody trying to get ahead, and thus the movements of all were impeded. But Joan had a cool head, the only cool head there, and she took command and brought order out of that chaos. She did her work quickly, and with decision and dispatch, and soon turned the panic flight into a quite steady going march. You will grant that for so young a person, and a girl at that, this was a good piece of work. She was 16 now, shapely and graceful, and of a beauty so extraordinary, that I might allow myself any extravagance of language in describing it, and yet have no fear of going beyond the truth. There was in her face a sweetness and serenity and purity that justly reflected her spiritual nature. She was deeply religious, and this is a thing which sometimes gives a melancholy cast to a person's countenance, but it was not so in her case. Her religion made her inwardly content and joyous, and if she was troubled at times, and showed the pain of it in her face and bearing, it came of distress for her country, no part of it was chargeable to her religion. A considerable part of our village was destroyed, and when it became safe for us to venture back there we realized what other people had been suffering in all the various quarters of France for many years, yes, decades of years. For the first time we saw wrecked and smoke-blackened homes, and in the lanes and alleys carcasses of dumb creatures, that had been slaughtered in pure wantonness, among them calves and lambs that had been pets of the children. And it was pity, to see the children lament over them. And then, the taxes, the taxes. Everybody thought of that. That burden would fall heavy now in the commune's crippled condition, and all faces grew long with the thought of it. Joan said, paying taxes with naught, to pay them with is what the rest of France has been doing these many years, but we never knew the bitterness of that before. We shall know it now. And so she went on talking about it, and growing more and more troubled about it, until one could see that it was filling all her mind. At last we came upon a dreadful object. It was the madman hacked and stabbed to death in his iron cage in the corner of the square. It was a bloody and dreadful sight. Hardly any of us young people had ever seen a man before who had lost his life by violence. So this cadaver had an awful fascination for us. We could not take our eyes from it. I mean, it had that sort of fascination for all of us but one. That one was Joan. She turned away in horror, and could not be persuaded to go near it again. There it is, a striking reminder that we are but creatures of use and custom, yes, and it is a reminder too, of how harshly and unfairly fate deals with us sometimes. For it was so ordered, that the very ones among us who were most fascinated with mutilated and bloody death were to live their lives in peace, while that other, who had a native and deep horror of it, must presently go forth, and have it as a familiar spectacle every day on the field of battle. You may well believe that we had plenty of matter for talk now, since the raiding of our village seemed by long odds the greatest event that had really ever occurred in the world. For although these dull peasants may have thought they recognized the bigness of some of the previous occurrences that had filtered from the world's history dimly into their minds, the truth is that they hadn't. One biting little fact, visible to their eyes of flesh, and felt in their own personal vitals, became at once more prodigious to them than the grandest remote episode in the world's history which they had got at second hand and by hearsay. It amuses me now, when I recall how our elders talked then. The fumed and fretted in a fine fashion. Ah, yes, said old Jacques d'Arc, things are come to a pretty pass, indeed. The king must be informed of this. It is time that he cease from idleness and dreaming, and get at his proper business. He meant our young disinherited king, the hunted refugee, Charles Vie. You weigh well, said the mayor. He should be informed, and that at once. It is an outrage that such things won't be permitted. Why, we are not safe in our beds, and he taking his case yonder. It shall be made known, indeed it shall, all France shall hear of it. To hear them talk, one would have imagined that all the previous 10,000 sackings and burnings in France had been but fables, and this one the only fact. It is always the way. Words will answer, as long as it is only a person's neighbor who is in trouble, but when that person gets into trouble himself, it is time that the king rise up and do something. The big event filled us young people with talk too. We let it flow in a steady stream, while we tended the flocks. We were beginning to feel pretty important now, for I was 18, and the other youths were from 1 to 4 years older young men, in fact. One day the paladin was arrogantly criticizing the patriot generals of France and said, look at Donois, bastard of Orleans, call him a general. Just put me in his place once, never mind what I would do. It is not for me to say. I have no stomach for talk. My way is to act and let others do the talking, but just put me in his place once, that's all. And look at Centrales, pooh. And that blustering liar, now what a general that is. It shocked everybody to hear these great names so flippantly handled, for to us these renowned soldiers were almost gods. In their far-off splendor they rose upon our imaginations dim and huge, shadowy and awful, and it was a fearful thing to hear them spoken of as if they were mere men, and their acts open to comment and criticism. Viola rose in Joan's face, and she said, I know not how any can be so hardy as to use such words regarding these sublime men, who are the very pillars of the French state, supporting it with their strength and preserving it at daily cost of their blood. As for me, I could count myself honored past all deserving, if I might be allowed, but the privilege of looking upon them once at a distance, I mean, for it would not become one of my degree to approach them too near. The paladin was disconcerted for a moment, seeing by the faces around him that Joan had put into words what the others felt. Then he pulled his complacency together, and fell to fault-finding again. Joan's brother John said, If you don't like what our generals do, why don't you go to the great wars yourself and better their work? You are always talking about going to the wars, but you don't go. Look you, said the paladin, it is easy to say that. Now I will tell you why I remain chafing here in a bloodless tranquility which my reputation teaches you is repulsive to my nature. I do not go, because I am not a gentleman. That is the whole reason. What can one private soldier do in a contest like this? Nothing. He is not permitted to rise from the ranks. If I were a gentleman, would I remain here? Not one moment. I can save France. Ah, you may laugh, but I know what is in me. I know what is hid under this peasant cap. I can save France, and I stand ready to do it, but not under these present conditions. If they want me, let them send for me. Otherwise, let them take the consequences. I shall not budge, but as an officer. Alas, poor France, France is lost, said Pierre Dark. Since you sniff so at others, why don't you go to the wars yourself, Pierre Dark? Oh, I haven't been sent for either. I am no more a gentleman than you. Yet I will go. I promise to go. I promise to go as a private under your orders when you are sent for. They all laughed, and the dragonfly said, So soon? Then you need to begin to get ready. You might be called for in 5 years, who knows? Yes, in my opinion you'll march for the wars in 5 years. He will go sooner, said Joan. She said it in a low voice and musingly, but several heard it. How do you know that, Joan? Said the dragonfly, with a surprised look. But John Dark broke in and said, I want to go myself, but as I am rather young yet, I also will wait and march when the paladin is sent for. No, said Joan, he will go with Pierre. She said it as one who talks to himself aloud without knowing it, and none heard it but me. I glanced at her, and saw that her knitting needles were idle in her hands, and that her face had a dreamy and absent look in it. There were fleeting movements of her lips, as if she might be occasionally saying parts of sentences to herself. But there was no sound, for I was the nearest person to her, and I heard nothing. But I set my ears open, for those two speeches had affected me uncannily, I being superstitious and easily troubled by any little thing of a strange and unusual sort. Noel Ringesson said, There is one way to let France have a chance for her salvation. We've got one gentleman in the commune, at any rate. Why can't the scholar change name and condition with the paladin? Then he can be an officer. France will send for him then, and he will sweep these English and Burgundian armies into the sea like flies. I was the scholar. That was my nickname, because I could read and write. There was a chorus of approval, and the sunflower said, That is the very thing that settles every difficulty. The Sieur de Conte will easily agree to that. Yes, He will march at the back of Captain Paladin and die early, covered with common soldier glory. He will march with John and Pierre, and live till these wars are forgotten, Joan muttered. And at the 11th hour Noel, and the Paladin will join these, but not of their own desire. The voice was so low, that I was not perfectly sure that these were the words, but they seemed to be. It makes one feel creepy to hear such things. Come now, Noel continued, it's all arranged. There's nothing to do but organize under the Paladin's banner and go forth and rescue France. You'll all join? All said yes, except Jacques d'Arc, who said, I'll ask you to excuse me. It is pleasant to talk war, and I am with you there, and I've always thought I should go soldiering about this time, but the look of our wrecked village, and that carved up and bloody madman have taught me that I am not made for such work and such sights. I could never be at home in that trade. Face swords and the big guns and death? It isn't in me. No, no, count me out. And besides, I'm the eldest son, and deputy prop and protector of the family. Since you are going to carry John and Pierre to the wars, somebody must be left behind to take care of our Joan and her sister. I shall stay at home, and grow old in peace and tranquility. He will stay at home, but not grow old, murmured Joan. The talk rattled on in the gay and careless fashion privileged to youth, and we got the Paladin to map out his campaigns and fight his battles, and win his victories and extinguish the English, and put our king upon his throne, and set his crown upon his head. Then we asked him what he was going to answer when the king should require him to name his reward. The Paladin had it all arranged in his head, and brought it out promptly. He shall give me a dukedom, name me premier peer, and make me hereditary Lord High Constable of France. And marry you to a princess, you're not going to leave that out, are you? The Paladin colored a trifle, and said, brusquely. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.